From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In 2003, a group of hairdressers from America went to Afghanistan to start a beauty school. They found Afghan women eager to learn. In fact, many had secretly done hair in underground salons during the Taliban era. The project is the subject of a documentary called The Beauty Academy of Kabul. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with the filmmaker, Liz Merman, and one of the teachers, Shema Ali, an Afghan-American who returned to her country after fleeing 20 years ago. Also, we talk with Craig Ferguson. He played a hairdresser in the movie The Big Tease, which he also wrote. In 2005, he became the host of CBS's The Late Late Show. He's just written his first novel. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After seeing so many women in Afghanistan hidden under burqas, it's fascinating to watch a group of women in Kabul talk about what beauty means to them and look back on the risks they took under the Taliban to get their hair done. The new documentary, The Beauty Academy of Kabul, follows a group of women from America who in 2003 opened a school in Kabul for aspiring hairdressers and beauticians. The school was funded by people in the American beauty industry. My guests are Liz Merman, the director of the film, and Shema Ali, who returned to Afghanistan to teach for several weeks at the academy. She'd fled Afghanistan with her two children after her husband was killed about 20 years ago when the country was under Soviet rule. She moved to New York, where she felt completely lost, until she followed through on a friend's suggestion that she enroll in a beauty school. Becoming a hairdresser, she says, saved her life and enabled her to support her two children. Director Liz Merman also made the documentary on Hostile Ground, which profiled three abortion providers in Buffalo after an OBGYN was killed by an extremist. Merman produced and edited ABC's anniversary special, Report from Ground Zero. Liz Merman, Shema Ali, welcome to Fresh Air. Liz, what interested you in the story of the Beauty Academy of Kabul?
Well, I just came across it in the newspaper, and I mean, it leapt out, as I'm sure it does to anyone who hears about it, as something that was so unusual and, to my mind, bizarre. I mean, it seemed, when I first heard about it, like the last thing that Afghanistan could possibly need. You know, roads, schools, hospitals seemed higher on the list. But something in the article really intrigued me, and it was the fact that under the Taliban, women had been running beauty salons in secret. And I thought, you know, if they're doing that at risk to, basically at risk to their lives, certainly putting their families at risk, you know, a very dangerous thing to do, then there must be something more going on. And my sort of dismissive reaction is kind of naive. And I was really intrigued to find out more about why this was something that was of interest to Afghans and who these American women who had this idea to go over there and do this would be. It just seemed like there was going to be a fabulous story there, no matter what the answers to those questions.
Shema, why did you want to teach at the Beauty Academy in Kabul?
Well, when I came to America, I got so involved with my life here, and my concentration was to do the best I can do for my children and for myself. I forget how it was, and really I didn't want to see too much of it. There was not too many news on American TV about Afghanistan. And after that, in every day, day and night, I came to see how terrible life is there and how badly people live. They have no meaning to make a living for, you know, there was no money, there was no job. Women was, you know, stuck in their house. So I was sort of very, very upset and depressed that, okay, now I'm a hairdresser. My whole being wanted to go there and do something and help and touch someone's life some way, somewhere, somehow. And I didn't know how. So this project came about, and it was like all those prayers that I was giving to God and doing this, and I didn't know how to go by it. I got a phone call, and they were talking about opening a beauty school in Kabul, and I say, oh, my God. So, of course, that's how, for me, it happened.
Your documentary, The Beauty Academy of Kabul, starts with a couple of the women who have just had their hair and makeup done, then putting on their scarves and explaining that one explains she has to hide her makeup and hair from her uncle, another doesn't want her husband to see it. And it made me think, what's the situation now for women who do want their hair done or who do want to hear, you know, wear makeup? What men in their lives do they have to hide it from?
Well, one thing I learned when I was there was that, you know, our concept of why we do our makeup and dress well and look good is very public. It's very much how you look walking down the street, how you look when you walk into your meeting, how you look when you're, you know, with your colleagues. And the women I met there explained it's much more about, you know, on the street you're covered up and you don't want people looking at you, but then you get to an engagement party and you're surrounded by your friends and your relatives and you want to, you know, look stunning for them. So it's much more, and often these parties are segregated. There's men on one floor, women on another. And it's really for the women in your lives and your friends and your neighbors and your relatives and your sort of status in that circle. And so the men, it's sort of, you know, it's not something that they need to know about. Maybe Shema can answer a little bit.
This was very, very new for me, too, because when I left, it wasn't like that. We all had, we all wanted to look good in public, too. We all had the latest haircut and wear makeup as much we were allowed to as young girls. And the woman that they were married and had your husband, they were allowed to go out in public and have makeup done and their hair was done. It's not like here that... just for yourself, you go and you need a haircut. You think that I need a haircut. Let me just go get a cut. But yes, occasions comes. Parties are fantastic. They are just so much overdoing their hair and makeup at times that you wonder. It's like you're hungry and you have a big plate of food and you want to finish it all at once. And that's how these women feel, that now they're allowed. So yes, they are not allowed right now. In their families for their grandfather to see them very made up or their hair is done or their uncles and their cousins. But I don't think their husbands mind seeing their wife looking good, but just they're not allowed to go in public just like that.
What kind of hairdos and what kind of makeup did the women in Kabul who you taught seem most interested in? Was it the kind of styles and makeup that we'd be seeing now in the United States?
No, not at all. They are very, very, they're following a lot of Indian movies there and everything that goes on in that culture. It's a lot of makeup. And one thing that I was trying to let them know and teach them that they wanted to all look very white. And the whitest makeup was possible, they wanted to apply it. They wanted to all have light, very light skin. And they put tons and tons of white makeup on. And they have, so they follow very, very high fashion, a lot of makeup, a lot of big eye makeup and lipsticks that is popping out from miles. What I should say really right now, we all migrated, a lot of us, in different countries. So a lot of people are going back from Iran, from Pakistan, from India, from Arab countries. And us, suppose, from America and Europe, we all bringing some kind of culture or trend or fashion from all these countries to Afghanistan. You don't see the fashion and the trend that was before I was there. You see a lot of fashion from all those countries. So it's too much, and that's how they like it.
Well, what kind of hair or makeup did you recommend that the women there found most baffling or most uninteresting, even though you thought it was the right stuff?
Well, younger women, they like softer style, softer makeup, but they have to compete with their cousins. They have to look like everybody else. So even if they like to, my idea of how to do their hair and their makeup, I have a story. I was doing a hair and makeup for one of the girls from the class. And I did a very nice, soft, we were shooting for Vogue magazine. And we wanted something that looked good in Vogue. I applied nice makeup on her. By the time I went to the other room and came back, she just did what she was used to. She just put that dark lipstick on, that dark lip liner on. And I said, you don't do that. There was a reason for me to do this for you. You have to learn to soften your makeup. She says, no, but that don't look good. It just, my lips has to be like this. So that's what they like. For now, that's what they like. See what happens in the future.
Liz, did it seem kind of surreal to you to have like Vogue magazine doing fashion shoots in the middle of Kabul?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, the Vogue visit was one of the more surreal experiences of my life.
Yeah, it's true.
They swept in for 3 days and swept out, you know, and the photographer, Jonathan Becker, had a cigar dangling from his lip the whole time.
Yeah, it was amazing.
And they brought this chest full of beautiful, exotic-looking clothes. And we'd been there at this point for 6 weeks, so we'd sort of settled in and knew the ups and downs. And, and you know, I mean, they were a bold bunch, and they were nervous, and they had all sorts. But, you know, they did it Vogue style, which is very different from low-budget documentary style.
So what did they dress the women in for the shoot?
Well, I guess I could jump into this because I'm in one of the pictures. And they had, I would say, I could say Arab-style dresses that they had for young girls, which two of my daughters is in one of the pictures with me that they have. What they have on is Vogue clothes. Yeah, and I had my own. It's very, they call it shalwar kameez. It's ethnic. It's a cloth from Pakistan. It's pretty. It's very nice, but it fit the situation or the style in Afghanistan. None of the dresses the clothing that we wore, was Afghan, but that's what they wanted to wear, and that's what we had on.
We're talking about the documentary, The Beauty Academy of Kabul. My guests are Liz Merman, the director of the film, and Shema Ali, who's taught at the school. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guests are Liz Merman and Shema Ali. Merman directed the new documentary, The Beauty Academy of Kabul, which is about a beauty school in Kabul where American and Afghani-American women and a couple of British women as well came to teach. And also with us is Shema Ali, who's an Afghan-American who returned to her country for the first time in 22 years to teach at the school. Shema, you left Afghanistan over 20 years ago. Would you tell a story of why you left?
I left during Russian invasion. And at that time, I lost my husband. And I was a month pregnant with my second child. My first child was 2.5 years old.
What happened to your husband?
Unfortunately, he got killed. He wasn't in the army, and my first child was 7 months old when this all started. So actually, I didn't see him. We were married 3 years. If we were together for 1.5 years was a lot, because then the war started and he had to go to fight against Mujahideen, because that's the government at that time was. And of course, he was against all of that. And many government changed during the 3-4 years at that time that I was there. So they told me that he was killed. It's like a closure that I probably will never find in my life. I never saw his body. We couldn't find him. He just disappeared. And a month later, they told us that he was buried in such and such cemetery. And so we have to, if you want to have a wake for him, you just go ahead and do. So then my own family, we are a very big family. I had 8 brothers and a sister. And at that time, they would just knock on the doors and take the young boys from their home, and you never saw them again. And my father couldn't bear to lose his sons like that.
Would they take them for the army? The Russians would take them for the army?
They would just take them for the army. They just gave them an arm and send them to the border to fight. And none of them ever came back, because they were 15, 16, 17 years old boys that they never had guns in their life in their hand, and they didn't know how to use them. There were no training. And they just want to have this huge amount of people standing against the enemy, suppose. And these poor young boys, they didn't know how to defend themselves. So many of them, they never came home. So my father decided that he has to rescue his sons and leave the country. And that's how we all had to leave, little by little. So by that time, there was no embassies of any countries in Afghanistan. There was no passport to give in, to no visas or anything of any country. So you just pack a bag and pray to God that you go to your destination safe and alive.
You know, you eventually went to a beauty school, and I think you opened up your own salon?
Yes, I have.
So did it ever seem shallow to you, or, you know, superficial to you, to spend so much time on women's hair and makeup, knowing what had happened to your country, knowing the dangers that your family had been in, knowing that your husband had been killed? Did beauty ever seem irrelevant, or did it give you a kind of pleasure that made it seem to have real value?
You know, in my situation, I had a background of, I had education back in Afghanistan. I had a very good job. I was working as a social worker for Planned Parenthood in Afghanistan. But when I came here, I had to make an honest living. And by having two young children, I didn't have many choices at that time. Of course, I wanted to go for higher education, have a better job, have a nice corporate job maybe. And beauty salons in my country, a hairdresser or beauticians, they are not people that they are appreciated in society so much. You're sort of a kind of a low life kind of a person that you had those many years ago. And it was not a respectful job. I had a hard time doing this because I still had the mentality from back home. I still didn't feel so proud of myself that I am a beautician. But when I was in it and when I found out that by me making somebody else feel good, it made me feel very good. I learned a lot from every client that I came in contact with, one way or the other. I learned to live a life that is good for me, it's respectful for me and for my children. And if I make them feel better, okay, maybe I don't have a chance to go and make my own people feel better. But I have to survive. I have to live. I have to make the best of what God gives me in this country. So I enjoyed it, as a matter of fact, and I enjoyed doing it very, very much.
So, Shema, you worked for Planned Parenthood in Afghanistan before you left. Yeah. I doubt Planned Parenthood survived the Taliban era in Afghanistan.
Oh, no, I don't think they are there.
What happened to your
colleagues? They were doing their own Planned Parenthood.
Yeah, really?
They didn't have to go through contraceptive. They were killing them, you know? So.
What happened to the women in Planned Parenthood who you had worked with?
Well, most of us all end up being here in America. As I hear they are in Virginia and California, some of us in Europe. So again, I have to make a point here. People that they were capable financially at that time, we all managed to leave. And again, to a point, we have better life than they have. You know, again, I have a job, I have a business. Like me, maybe a lot other Afghan women that they left the country. So we were able to leave and make a living for us somewhere else. And those people that they left behind, they are the ones that they are suffering then and they are suffering now. And I think they always suffer because the opportunities are not too great for them there.
Or are there places in Afghanistan that you had memories of that you wanted to see again when you went back to the beauty academy in Kabul? Did you want to revisit your old home or school or any place like that?
Yes, and I did. I revisited my old home, my father's home, my grandfather and my mother's grave, my old little home that I left behind, just locked the door and I left. I went to my old school that was completely destroyed. With the fear that I had, I couldn't, at that time when I went, I couldn't walk on the street that I walked 22 years ago. I couldn't look at the people's eyes that if I did 22 years ago. It was a fear of they recognize me that I am from outside. I am not part of them as much as I wanted to be. 22 years made a big, big gap between my life and their life. So I went to all those places. The feelings, they were very, very sad. They were very upsetting because what I left behind, I couldn't find it back. It was gone.
When you said you walked down the streets with fear, do you mean fear or guilt?
At that time, it's combined of both of them, really, fear and guilt. Guiltiness of...
like a survivor's guilt.
You know, yeah, it is survivor's guilt, but still, I still have a better life than them. You know, I'm still saying, okay, you know, here I come from America, and I'm here to teach you to do your hair and your makeup, and they are looking at me, maybe they are saying, what the hell you are doing here? Where were you 20 years ago, you know? I cannot go with this feeling that, okay, I'm here I come and accept me with your open arm and take care of me or not be jealous of me, because it's not possible. They have to feel that way, and I had to feel guilty about that.
Shema Ali has taught at the Beauty Academy of Kabul. We'll talk more about the new documentary, The Beauty Academy of Kabul, in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of A Tale of Two Cities by Charles Dickens, available in stores and online. From GM, offering vehicles that can run on E85 ethanol, an alternative fuel made from corn. Details at livegreengoyellow.com. And from Capella University, an accredited university offering more than 20 doctoral degree programs online at capella.edu. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more about the Beauty Academy of Kabul, and we talk with Craig Ferguson. He played a hairdresser in the film The Big Tease. On The Drew Carey Show, he was Carey's boss. Now he hosts The Late Late Show on CBS, and he's just written his first novel. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We've been talking about the new documentary, The Beauty Academy of Kabul. It's about a group of women from America who opened a beauty school in Kabul in 2003. Shema Ali returned to Afghanistan to teach in the school. She'd fled the country 20 years ago when it was under Soviet rule. Liz Merman is the director of the film. Liz, one of the points your movie makes is that during the years of the Taliban regime, the official salons were closed, but a lot of underground salons opened in the homes of women. Can you tell us what you learned about those home salons that existed during the Taliban days?
Sure. I mean, one of the first things I learned was that a lot of people who were doing hairdressing in Kabul right now were from backgrounds where this would not have been an acceptable career. It would never have crossed their minds to do hairdressing. They were teachers. They were working in government ministry. Some of them were, you know, studying to be doctors. And, you know, these were women who had very different professional ambitions and professional expectations. But, you know, after hiding in their basements from bombs for a number of years and then the Taliban coming in and the schools shutting down, none of them could work outside the homes. A lot of them, their fathers, their husbands, the men in their families, didn't toe the Taliban line. They lost their jobs as well. So people had to find things they could do in their houses to support themselves. And so beauty salons sort of popped up as this cottage industry, because even though none of this was officially allowed under the Taliban, people were still having secret wedding parties and engagements. I mean, life had to go on. Mm-hmm. And so women were sneaking into these salons. They were getting themselves done up for wedding parties, and then they were sneaking out. And, you know, I mean, the nice thing about a burqa is that no one can see what's going on underneath. So they could manage to get away with this to some extent. And, I mean, one of the women who we visit in the film talks about how she had this underground salon. Her daughters were working with her. She says, you know, at one point in the film, Taliban wives would come. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was important to them. They could get away with it. And people would sneak in and out. Everyone knew this was going on. They just tried to keep it from the men. And the other thing she told me was that, you know, the only other form of income they had was for her children, very young boys, to be weaving carpets. And she didn't want them doing this. It was a terribly unhealthy thing to do. So by running a beauty salon, she was saving her children and she was supporting her family. And so when the Taliban left and women were allowed to return to other sorts of jobs, a lot of them realized that this was a much more viable career. They could make better money doing this than they could make going back and working for the state, being teachers. And on the one hand, you could argue that those jobs are more necessary for Afghanistan right now. But when you've got a big family to feed and you've got two families living in half a destroyed house and, you know, your husband's disabled from the war or dead, then arguments about what your country needs and what your family needs become a little bit more complicated.
Liz, the teachers in the Beauty Academy of Kabul who are in your documentary are a mix of nationalities, American, British, Afghani-American. A couple of the American teachers, I have to say, seem like they're almost there because they need to express their personal identity in some way. And they seem to be just, like, slightly inappropriate in what they're doing. Like, one of them's, like, teaching, like, I mean, I'm not sure if she's American or, mm-hmm. or British, but she's trying to teach the women from Afghanistan and the Beauty Academy about meditation. And there seems something just very presumptuous in her approach mm-hmm. to doing it. Like, she knows something spiritual that they couldn't possibly know. And one of them's kind of criticizing the women because they haven't shown up with their makeup on and they have to set an example for other women. And
right.
I'm wondering what your reaction was to those moments that struck me as very uncomfortable.
Well, I mean, I had two reactions. As a filmmaker, I thought this is an incredible moment of cross-cultural interaction and I'm fascinated by it. As a person, you know, I mean, obviously, one of the things I love about this story is that it's about two very different cultures meeting and women with very different experiences of life getting to know each other. And there are comic moments in that. I think that the women in the school would acknowledge that as well. You know, at the same time, I personally, you know, it's not the way I would have approached these things. And it's not the way most people watching the film. I mean, there's this sort of shock of meditation. Why do they need that? That's the last thing they need. But, you know, everyone has these Americans, they picked up, they left their jobs, they were doing it for no money. They just wanted to help. And they all had their own ways of of doing that, and it seemed sort of wacky to me. I mean, I'd be lying if I didn't say so. But hey, you know, it came from their hearts, and they picked themselves up and took a great risk and went over there. And the Afghan women, you can see in their faces in the film, they're smiling, they're raising their eyebrows. They take it the way they want to take it. Some of them, by the end of it, they were into meditation. You know, some of them were, some of them weren't. But I think that it was a fun experience for the Afghan students to sort of see these, you know, strange American approaches and get to chat about that amongst themselves.
Liz Merman, one of the things I really like about your documentary, The Beauty Academy of Kabul, is that it gives us a chance to see and listen to women of Afghanistan without being covered up. You know, I mean, we get to see their faces, and we get to see their faces looking real good because they've just, you know, they've just had their hair and makeup done, and they're all really happy about it. Is that one of the reasons why you wanted to make the movie, so that we could see women of Afghanistan talking about their lives in a different setting and from a different point of view, and literally see them?
Absolutely. I mean, when I started this project, I had just gotten off of doing an anniversary special about the World Trade Center attacks. And, you know, I was sort of seeped in that sense of, you know, Afghanistan is the place where Al-Qaeda is and bin Laden is. And it's a scary place and it's a war zone. And that's sort of all we heard. So I really loved the idea of making a film about Afghanistan that wasn't just about the war, where you would really get a feel for what people were like and what lives were like. And so, you know, when I heard about this beauty school, I thought, well, what a great way to find out what women are really talking about. Because you go to a beauty salon and you gossip and you talk about what matters to you. And so, you know, Shamo was saying earlier, people don't like to talk about the tragedy. When I sat down and I interviewed the students in the film, you know, I kind of knew, I had television funding behind me. I knew that they were going to want some horror stories. And women just didn't want to talk about that. And when they do, they talk about it very lightly. And they sort of smile and laugh after they tell you something awful. Yeah. And then they move on to what they care about, which is stories about, you know, love and marriage and hair. And they would just light up when they were talking about these things. And I felt, as a filmmaker, uncomfortable pushing people to talk about the trauma. And everyone would go there a little bit, and you'd sort of feel how much they want to talk about. And then they go back to what they really wanted to talk about. And you just saw them being engaged and lively and excited about something because, you know, they were finally not hiding from bombs or hiding from the Taliban or going through the hell that they'd been through for the past almost 30 years.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Liz Merman directed the documentary The Beauty Academy of Kabul. We also heard from one of the teachers, Shema Ali. The film is currently playing in several cities, including New York and Chicago. It opens this Friday in Los Angeles and in more cities over the next few weeks. There's more information on the movie and where to see it on our website, freshair.npr.org. Coming up, the host of The Late Late Show, Craig Ferguson. He's just written his first novel. This is Fresh Air. Since 2005, David Letterman has been followed each weekday night by Craig Ferguson on The Late Late Show. Until he became the unlikely host of the show, this Scottish actor, writer, and comic was best known in the U.S. for his starring role in the comedy The Big Tease, which he also wrote, and for playing the boss on The Drew Carey Show. Now he's written his first novel. It's called Between the Bridge and the River. Two of the main characters, Saul and Leon, are half-brothers, the love children of Frank Sinatra and Peter Lawford. They start their own church, but first they take a road trip through the American South.
For most of the way, Route 40 follows old Route 66, a highway white America remembers fondly because for them it conjures up a time of innocence before cigarettes gave people cancer and gasoline fumes burned a hole in the sky, a time before homosexuality and drugs, a time when the only threats to the world were Soviet Russia, aggressive extraterrestrials, or perhaps the occasional mutant insect that had inadvertently fallen into a nuclear reactor and grown to 5,000 times its original size and was intent on eating Chicago. In short, Route 66 was a symbol of what white America is really nostalgic for, a time that never existed. Sol and Leon were, of course, white American. They used history, their countries and their own, and any suitable religious doctrine to suit their own ends. They were survivors, like roaches. Sol and Leon were barkers at the carnival tent catering to the low-income end of America's spiritually disenfranchised. Historically, it is better for religions to cater to the poor because there is always more of them. They are more desperate, so therefore they will cough up as much money and devotion as they can. Plus, their life on Earth is unpleasant enough for them to buy the idea that things might actually improve after death.
Craig Ferguson reading from Between the Bridge and the River, his first novel. Writing a book was new to him, but he spent a lot of time writing his monologues for The Late Late Show, which aren't always about the day's events. Perhaps your most talked about monologue was the one that you did after your father died. Mm. And I'm wondering how you decided to do that, how you decided to actually mention it, and not only to mention it, but to really talk about him for a while. You know, and it wasn't, I mean, there was funny stuff in it, but it wasn't meant to, like, crack up the audience. I mean, it was a pretty reflective monologue.
Yeah, the thing about the monologue is most nights I understand that my job is to keep it light and to entertain, but I tell the truth on that show. I made a decision I went through a divorce a couple of years ago, and I realized that, you know, a lot of the stuff that I'd made, I think I'd made like two movies I liked and everything, and a couple of episodes of the Drew Carey show that I'd been on I liked, and everything else I'd done I thought was junk. And I thought, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm going to do exactly what I want. So I'm going to write a book that I want to write. I'm going to do a show that I want to do. So when it came to, you know, my father's passing, the option was I could either not do a show or ignore it and do a bunch of jokes about, I don't know, the weather or the playoffs or, you know, Paris Hilton. You know, I don't care for that. And there's plenty of other channels to get that on. You know, I do the show that I want to do, and if anyone wants to watch it, that's great. And I want them to watch it. It's not like I'm trying to exclude people. I want people to watch the show, but not at the expense of my own sanity or my own life. So, you know, I talk about my life in the show, and I'll talk about what happened in my life. And that's a big deal when a parent dies. I'm not going to, you know, it was my dad. I loved him. I wanted to talk about him. And it seemed the appropriate thing to do. I called my mother first and asked her what she thought. And she said, yeah, do it. Do whatever you think's right.
You know, one of the things you mentioned in that monologue about your father is that when you were in rehab to give up drinking, you said your father came to visit you and he said, well, Craig, I'm not going to stop drinking.
That's right. Again,
I thought that was a really funny moment. And I couldn't help but wonder, what did you think at that moment when he said it to you?
I think at that point, it's hard to recall. When I was in rehab, it was 14 years ago, and I understandably, my brains were a little fried at the time. I do remember thinking it was funny. The main thing I remember is that my parents had to cross, you know, the entire United Kingdom. I was in rehab in southern England, and they crossed the country to come and visit me in this, you know, kind of rather swanky, I think, treatment center. I mean, I was in on credit. I had no money, but they came to this very alien environment, and I was kind of touched by it. They didn't understand it. They didn't really understand what was going on with me, but they knew that I was in trouble. I knew I was in trouble. And I think that, you know, that was just, it was my dad. He was kind of uncompromising. There was something reassuring about it, actually, I suppose. I think I remember thinking that. I didn't want my dad to give up drinking and start giving me hugs and talking about his inner child. That would have made me very uncomfortable.
How did you know you were in trouble?
Oh, I think there was some evidence, you know, the way that drinking manifested itself for me. I couldn't tell you with any degree of certainty what was going to happen if I had a drink. I might go out and have a drink and be very nice and come home, you know, a couple of hours later. I might go out for a, you know, with that intention to do that and wake up 4 days later in another country. So It was a very random and weird experience, the drinking. But I've been, I guess it's over 14 years now since I had a drink, so I probably have been off the stuff as long as I was on it.
Would you describe where you grew up in Scotland?
Yeah, where I grew up in Scotland was a town called Cumbernauld, which is about 15 miles outside the big industrial city of Glasgow. Glasgow was heavily bombed during the Second World War, so Cumbernauld, although it was a tiny village and dates back to Roman times, the village itself, it's a big, sprawling new town. It was built very quickly in the late 50s, early 60s and 70s. They built houses upon houses upon houses upon houses, and there weren't a lot of facilities other than houses. And a lot of the people that moved there were coming from Glasgow. They were misplaced. They were a little anxious to be there. It was a rough place. It was a rough town. I think it was voted even recently the second worst place in Britain to live.
Did it feel like a bad place to you?
I wasn't aware of it feeling that bad. It doesn't even feel like a bad place to me now. What it was I realised looking back on it now, was the constant threat of violence was what I found intimidating. Now, the other people who have grown up there will tell you that that's not true, and maybe that's not true for them, but I felt, you know, especially as a young man, you're a target for other young men, and there was a lot of sectarian violence, there was a lot of anger, there was a lot of drinking, you know, outside. My home was actually a kind of a haven, but outside the home, was terrible, and the schools were terrible. To my mind, I didn't find the schools in any way. Well, I only went to one, but the school that I went to was, corporal punishment was still in place. It was outlawed in Scotland in 1979 by the European Court of Human Rights, which was a problem for me because I left school in 1978. So the teachers were state endorsed bullies. You know, they would hit you, they would hurt you.
Well, you quit school when you were 15 or 16.
Yeah, I did. I walked out on it. I didn't like it.
So when you quit, what did you do?
I drank mostly for a while. I drank and I was a drummer in punk rock bands, which punk rock was very kind of popular at the time. And I had this ratty old drum kit and I made a living playing it. I wasn't a bad drummer, so I would kind of be a jobbing drummer for punk rock bands. It's in a punk rock band, in rock and roll, it's very important that someone can actually keep the time while everybody else goes nuts. That's what I did, and I kind of worked in bars and I bussed around, and I worked as a bar. The reason I actually get into show business is I worked in a bar next to a theatre, and I was the bartender there, and the guy that used to come in, that used to run the theatre, who's now the artistic director of the Royal Shakespeare Company. But he came in, his name's Michael Boyd, and he said, you know, he would talk to me, and I was behind the bar, and you're kind of on show when you're a bartender in a busy bar. And I kind of became a pet to these actors, you know, and they kind of invited me into the theatre, and I kind of drifted in that way.
And you found you liked it?
I did like it. I liked show business because it seemed to be very forgiving of drunkenness. And also, you know, you could work while you were drunk. And there were a lot of very attractive girls who also were much friendlier than any girls I'd met before.
Well, you're making it seem that it was lucky you were drunk. Otherwise, you never would have gotten into show business.
Oh, I don't for a second discount alcohol. I'm not a temperance campaigner in any way, shape or form. I'm quite clear on alcohol saved my life at times. You know, it was the medication which I was trying to even out, I think, a lot of the time with alcohol. I think if I could drink alcohol, I would drink it. I am not in any way, shape or form anti-alcohol. I'm anti the way I drank it.
My guest is Craig Ferguson, host of The Late Late Show on CBS and author of the new novel Between the Bridge and the River. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
My guest is Craig Ferguson. He hosts The Late Late Show after David Letterman on CBS, and he's just written his first novel called Between the Bridge and the River. So how did you get to the United States?
Well, it was a circuitous route. I mean, I came here in 1976 with my father, and so we came over to visit then, and it was 1976. I was 13, and, you know, America was going through the bicentennial, so it was a very exciting time to be here. And also, I was at a very impressionable age, and I loved America. I loved America before because it was the source of all glamour. You know, superheroes, cowboys, rock and roll, everything came from America. So to actually get to America from Scotland at that time, I at that point swore I would come back. And then I came back when I was 21, and lived in New York City for a while, for a year, working in a construction site in Harlem, and living in the East Village, which anyone will tell you is a bit of a commute. So I would work in this construction site during the day, and then there was a bar at that time called The Last Resort, which is now called Coyote Ugly in the East Village, which they made that movie about dancing about, which used to have what they called the American Modern Dance Theater, which is a very grand name for a bunch of gay men that wore black clothing and, you know, danced around. And they invited me to join their happy band, and I did. At that time I was married to a Scottish girl, and we were both, you know, we became the pets of this fabulous bunch of guys in the East Village. So I would dance with these guys in the evening and do construction during the day, which you don't need to go to the gym if you do that. But I was 21 then. I don't think I could do it anymore.
One of the movies that you co-wrote and co-starred in, well, you really starred in this one, The Big Tease. You play a gay character. He's a hairdresser from Scotland who wants to compete in the big haircutting competition in the United States, and he thinks he's invited. And when he gets to Los Angeles, he finds out he was actually invited to be in the audience, not to be in the competition. So then he has to figure out how to actually get into the competition. So, yeah.
Well, that's very much my life in LA. When I came to LA in 95, I thought I was invited, and I found out I was invited to be in the audience. I mean, the reason why, you know, it was set in the world of hairdressing is I wanted to use a business that took itself very seriously, that doesn't really matter that much. And that's why I chose, you know, the hairdressing as an allegory for show business. It's just the same, you know.
So did you have to learn how to cut hair to convincingly do the part?
A little bit, although I wouldn't trust me with doing your haircut now. I did a little bit of haircutting, but mostly it was funny. I came home. They were long hours. It was an independent film. I'd been working an 18-hour day one day, and I came home. It was we'd worked through the night. It was late on in the afternoon. I came home one of my then-wife's friends, who was a gay man who was helping us decorate the house, was hanging some drapes. And when I came home, I lay on the couch. I was exhausted, and I went, I am so tired of being gay. And it's funny, he turned and he looked at me and he said, it can be work sometimes. And I thought it was so gracious and so funny. I do have this kind of great affection for the gay community. Because I was in the East Village, I was made very, very welcome there. And of course, it was just at the time that the AIDS thing was, a lot of these guys didn't make it through, you know, the first wave of this stuff. And it was a very kind of welcoming, very folksy, very homey environment. So that's why I used a gay character.
Another role that made you well-known before The Late Late Show was your role as Drew Carey's boss on The Drew Carey Show. How did you get that job? Were you already part of, like, the comedy circuit in America? Did Drew Carey know you from that?
No, not at all. Why? That was a very odd story. What happened was I was actually broke. I was down to my last 27 cents. I had 27 cents in the bank, which I don't know if you've ever tried to get 27 cents out of the bank. You can't do it. It costs a buck to take out 27 cents. It can't be done. So I was broke, and I had this manager at the time who got me this audition to play the part of the Hispanic photographer on the Brooke Shields sitcom Suddenly Susan. And I said, this is ridiculous. I looked at the script and I said, this part is for a Latino man. And he said, oh, you're foreign. Just go to the audition. And I had nothing else to do. So I went. And I went to the audition, and what happened was that, you know, I get to the corridor, and, you know, outside the audition, there's a bunch of guys who all look like Antonio Banderas sitting there, and we're, you know, they kind of look at me, I'm, you know, como estas, everybody, and I go in, and, you know, the producers laugh when I start talking, or even when they see me, about, you know, how inappropriate I am for the job. But one of the casting directors there was a guy called Tony Sepulveda from Warner Brothers Casting, and after the audition he said, you're not really what we're looking for the Hispanic photographer, but we are doing a show with a guy from Cleveland. Can you do an English accent? And I said, sí, señor, I can. And it was for auditioning for a job I was hopelessly wrong for. So it was a real lesson about showing up, even when you think it's ridiculous.
Craig Ferguson, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me into your humble... No, it's not so humble, is it? Your very fancy studio.
Craig Ferguson hosts The Late Late Show on CBS. His new novel is called Between the Bridge and the River. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Ian Chillog directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Hand in Glove, a novel of psychological suspense by Robert Goddard, author of Play to the End. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art and its current exhibition of paintings by Edvard Munch, MOMA.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Psychologist Dan Gottlieb had been a quadriplegic for over 20 years when he learned his grandson had autism. In a series of letters to his grandson, Gottlieb wrote down his thoughts about being different. On the next Fresh Air, Letters to Sam. Also, Paul Weitz, director of the new comedy American Dreams. Join us for the next Fresh Air.